This is an oral history interview with Professor Ali Gosangolo, conducted on the 25th of July, 2013. Let's start with the early influences shaping your intellectual career. The interviewer is Crawford Young. Starting with the early influences shaping your intellectual career, could you say a few words about your family background in Eastern Congo and the childhood influences that might have set you on the kind of path that you wound up taking?
Well, my family influences, I think, were not destined to take me on the path that I've followed. And I don't know where it might have been. One thing I can say right away is that my father, realizing that during colonial days, I mean, I was born in the middle of the 20th century, in 1945, he decided at some point, I was 10 years old, I believe, that I should learn to type. I was 10 years old, and he hired a typist to teach me to type, because at the time in the colony, a Congolese didn't have too many opportunities to do a lot of things. You could become a teacher, you could become a typist, perhaps a clerk, an accountant, or something like that. So that was one very interesting thing. At the time, I didn't realize how important it was. That became very important even when I came to the US. Knowing how to type became extremely useful to me. So my father was a very important influence on me. He believed very deeply in education, even though he himself had not had any formal education. He taught himself how to read and write. And while he worked for a Belgian man who was an administrator of cotton production and shipping, he even learned some French and loved to talk French to me. And everything he did, I think, for me was to push me on into education. At the time, there was nothing that could have foretold what I was going to become, but it was important to be educated as far as he was concerned. So, and he had a dream for me, which I ultimately did not follow. I tried, but I couldn't. He wanted me to become a doctor. That's one of the two things that he had. The other one was for me to become a director of what? He never said. And what he said at the time was that, when he sees doctors and directors, they don't leave home without a jacket or a suit on. So, and I must say also right away that I was fortunate, and in general I've been more fortunate than most, at least most from the Congo. I was fortunate to have survived. I was born right after World War II. Infant mortality was great. My mother had 11 pregnancies, but for the most part I grew up alone in the house because she lost some of those pregnancies. Other children were born, stillborn. Others died very young. My only surviving brother was not born until 14 years after me. So early on, I was an only child. And even when my brother came, by then I'd moved to the boarding school. So those are some of the things. And I might add also that, as you know, there was no border between Congo, Rwanda, and Burundi. They were all administered by Belgium. And so Though I was born in Congo, in Uvira, in the city of Uvira, when I became conscious of things, we were in Burundi, we were living in Burundi, and my family lived there for quite some time.
And you grew up as a polyglot youngster who knew some French, who presumably also knew the regional language, Swahili, and your own maternal language of Bembin.
Absolutely, yes. The first language I spoke was Swahili, because in Eastern Congo, if you're born in the city, you meet people from, you know, many places. And this is true of other parts of Congo as well. The regional languages, vehicular languages that permit communication between people from different ethnicities. So the very first language I spoke was Swahili, and I had to learn Ebembe later when I went to spend vacation time with my grandmother in the village. But in the city, it was Swahili, and French was around, but the formal learning of French did not start until I was seven and went to second grade back in the Congo from Bujumbura in Burundi then. So you grew up speaking several languages without thinking about it. Yeah, and in fact, my father did not want me to learn my ethnic language. It's languages have a hierarchy. He basically wanted me to speak Swahili, and then when French came in, he wanted me to speak French most of the time. It's interesting. I traveled with him when I was 15 years old, and we were in a train in Tanzania, and he wanted to say something important to me, and he was caught in a bind because he had to speak to me in Ebembe, because everybody around spoke Swahili, and what he wanted to tell me was that it was to be careful because there were thieves in the train.
So, beyond your father, were there other role models that were influential with you? You suggested that you really didn't have any intimations of the future that was in store for you, or you couldn't imagine winding up teaching in a great big university in an Anglophone environment 10,000 miles away.
Not at all. I should say another, you know, of course my mother was very important, although she was always in the background, never having learned to read or write herself, although I took it upon myself when I was in already well advanced in grade school to teach older women, including my mother, how to read and write during vacation time. But she was a different kind of influence in that, she spoke to me about, you know, community, without calling it that, but how one behaves in community and so forth. She was always there. And I didn't realize this then, but later in life, when she visited me, I realized during our conversations that many of the things she was saying when I was growing up, she was still saying them when I was 40 years old. So my mother, but I also had an uncle who became very influential when my father died. My father died when I was 17 years old. I was still in high school. And if it weren't for this uncle who just died last year, I might not have finished high school because he was determined also to follow in the path that my father had set, and he himself had fallen under my father's influence, forcing him to go to school. I remember I must have been 4 or 5, my father coming to his younger brother almost every day asking him when he was going to go to school, until he did go to school.
So, well, you grew up, or your coming of age was at a politically agitated period in your native land. Firstly, the independence. Do you if you were born in 1945, you would have been 15 when, or 13 when politics came to Eastern Congo.
Yeah.
Do you recollect being caught up in that moment?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, you know, we heard a lot about Lumumba and Kasavubu and so forth early on. In fact, Lumumba and Kasavubu, and at the time, until 1961, I was living in Bujumbura in Burundi, and they came to visit the Congolese community in Bujumbura, and we saw them, I saw them, together at the time. They were still, on good terms. And the Congolese community, which dominated the city of Bujumbura, was very, very political. And everybody there had someone in the politics that they supported. And Lumumba had by far the largest following in that city. So that later, when he was assassinated in 1961, by then I was in Bukavu, we, from the high schools, we staged demonstrations, because we were very much politically aware. We staged demonstrations at the consulates, Western consulates that were there, because we were not fooled that he had just been killed by some village people. We knew exactly what had happened.
Then you left Bujumbura in 1961, you said, and returned to Congo. Mm-hmm. And so you then lived through that second phase of intense political, and in this case violent, experience in the rebellions that swept the country in 63 to 65.
You know, I was very fortunate, Crawford. I did not know that. I did not know those experiences, because I left in July of 1963, before the Mulele rebellion took over and the Skrammer invasion of Bukavu. In fact, my high school was bombed by Skrammer forces this September or October 1963, just a few months after I left. So I knew the Mulele rebellion, well, I mean, I was reading about it here, and my family was telling me about it. In fact, most of my family had fled as refugees while I was here. I had come here under an exchange program following my high school. It was going to be a one-year exchange program, and after which I was to return to Congo, and I did. But when I got to Kinshasa, I could not make contact with my family, because where I knew they were supposed to be, they were not. They had all fled, some, most to Burundi, but some as far away as Tanzania, and I had no place to go. And in a way, again, my good fortune, the family that I lived with here in the U.S. made it possible for me to come back the same year, 1964 that was. And in fact, that was the best way to make contact with my family again, because they knew how to get a hold of me. I did not know how to get a hold of them. They didn't have an address. They had my address where I had been in Iowa. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So really, when I actually saw the results of the rebellions of 1963 to 65 was when I went back in 1969 and saw how violent it had been, and heard many stories, so much so that at times they were so unbelievable that at times I thought I was going to sort of pass out just listening to these stories. Yeah.
So you were in the United States as an exchange student
mm-hmm.
in
63 to 64, yes.
And where were you located?
I was in a small place called Kelowna, Iowa, living on a farm.
Uh-huh.
You know, the program that brought me here was called the International Christian Youth Exchange. That had begun apparently in Congo at independence, but in Congo and Ethiopia, I was told. But it's a program that had been created after World War II to foster understanding between peoples. And it had been working especially in Germany and Europe in general, Latin America and so forth. When Congo became independent, they decided to extend it to Congo. And the first two or three years, they brought students who stayed here for college, including Georges Nzongula and Georges Bokamba. They were part of that program.
Okay.
But our contingent of 1963, we were told we had to now, like the other countries were doing, go back to Congo.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So, here you come from Eastern Congo to a farm in Iowa in what I presume was an entirely white community. This must have been quite a trauma, is not the right word, but certainly culture shock.
It was a big culture shock. First of all, I arrived in mid-July. It was something like 90 degrees and about 90% humidity. And I thought, this can't be. We grew up thinking of the North always being cold. And then people were looking at me and saying, you must feel at home. And they were surprised when I said that I'd never known heat this intense. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that, you know, having seen a few movies from the U.S. were mostly Indians and cowboys. When I landed at the airport, and at the time there was an airport in Iowa City, I fully expected my family to come get me on horseback. And here they came driving the biggest car I've ever seen, a DeSoto. You know, in my mind, I said, that can't be a car. It looks like a boat. So that was a second shock. That's all that just in the first day. And then they had planned that first evening to take me into town, the town of Kelowna, because there was a tractor pulling contest. And so I was there watching these tractors, you know, pulling great heavy weights. I did not know the objective of that. Then we went back to the house. We came back in the evening to the same place. Obviously, it must have been the annual festival in the town. And there was a softball game. Now I know it's softball. But I was just amazed to see so many people being enthused by something that did not seem to make sense to me. And everybody was wearing blue jeans, overalls. And everybody, I had never seen that many white people together. But not only that, everybody seems to be red in the face and the neck. Well, I understood later they were all farmers having, you know, worked all day under the very hot sun. So those were the first shocks, but, you know, food and so forth. Although, where food is concerned, you know, I was again fortunate to have started high school at the time, 1957, when high schools were being desegregated. So I moved into the boarding school with Belgian kids. Not everybody was admitted, but you know, they were very selective about the Africans that could go to those schools. And And so in high school, for instance, all my high school, I never had a Congolese teacher. They were all Belgians until 1962, when the Belgians left and they were replaced by Haitians. Mm-hmm. Haitians, you know, mostly probably refugees from the Papadoc regime, probably from France and from Canada. Yeah. So, so you know, arriving in Kelowna, Iowa was a great shock.
So, you wound up in Goshen College. Did you try to find a place at Lovanium at the time, or Kisangani, or Lubumbashi?
No, I didn't. I didn't because, you know, it was when I was going to go back in 1964 that I was going to start the university, and I had, of course, thought of Lubumbashi probably more than Kinshasa, but I wasn't. I had not reached that point yet. You know, all of us in high school, especially those of us who went to the Belgian high schools, Athénée Royal, our dream was not necessarily to go to Congolese universities. We fully expected to go to university in Belgium. Uh-huh. And there were a few. I had a cousin who had left in 1962, and by 1964 I was expecting to go to Belgium and would have gone to either Lubumbashi or Kinshasa if that had failed. And indeed, I think I had the grades that it took to go to Belgium.
But you wound up then finally at Goshen College.
Yes, and finally is a good word, because before Goshen there is something else. I did 2 years at a junior high school in Kansas. Because a family that was helping me to go to college had good contacts there. I went there for 2 years, but both of those are Mennonite colleges, and I lived in a Mennonite family. And so it was the normal progression to go to Heston and then on to Goshen College.
I see.
So that's what I did. Both places were actually attractive to me, in part because they had a good soccer program. So I played soccer quite a bit. Yes, and it was actually at Heston already that the dream of becoming a doctor that my father had for me sort of died. Mm-hmm. Under circumstances that now I think could have been different, had my advisors there known what my background was, mm-hmm. because they were used to having African students from Tanzania and Kenya mostly, and some from Ethiopia perhaps. Anyway, students who knew English already. And English per se was not the problem, but scientific English. So the, you know, when I was in high school back home in Congo, science was supposed to be part of pre-medical training. However, Latin and Greek were much more important. And so I studied Latin. I didn't study Greek, but I studied Latin and mathematics. You know, the high school was divided up into four different sections. There was Greek, Latin, mathematics, economics, and scientific. And those of us who wanted to do medicine, and as you know, in that system, in the European system, you go from high school to medical school. So those of us who wanted to be doctors were strongly advised to take Latin math, and that's where I was. But we had not sufficiently studied, you know, biology, chemistry, physics, to make it once I got to college. And in addition, I arrived at Heston almost a month late because of things that were happening back home. And so I never caught up, especially in chemistry. And so my advisor, who was also the dean of the faculty, called me in and said, look, you know, I don't think you're going to make it because we already have here other African students whose English is not, you know, permitting them to do the sciences and so forth. So, you know, think about something else. Later I discovered that their high school training was not nearly as good as mine, and that, you know, given a year without having to take those courses, I might have made it. But, you know, I easily went into languages and literature. At the time, Spanish and German. I added to French. I didn't do French then. Even at Goshen, I majored in French. I majored in Spanish. Yes, because by then I was beginning to think of what I would do after leaving college. I was beginning to think about a PhD, and it was going to be in Romance philology. Why Romance philology? Well, that's simply because many of my Belgian teachers were had diplomas, some of them PhD. My principal had a PhD in Romance philology. Okay. I didn't know exactly what it was, but I thought that was something that would be good to do.
So, by this time, were you contemplating at all staying in the U.S. permanently?
It took me a while to get to reconcile with the idea of staying in the U.S. permanently. I think it was only when I got tenure, which was, probably 1979, that I realized that perhaps I should make a career of it. It was always the next step. You know, at the next step, I'll go home. And when I got my BA at Goshen, that was one of those steps. I had really three options. One was to go home. Another was to play professional soccer. And a third was to go to graduate school. And I decided I would go to graduate school if somebody gave me support. Because I didn't have a way to do it otherwise. So I began to apply. Actually, going home was not that imminent. It was not the top thing. I wanted to pursue more education. And so I applied to a number of places. At the time, I did not know the difference between various universities. So I applied, I believe, to Indiana University, Iowa, and I don't remember what else. And Iowa is the one that came up with a scholarship. Mm-hmm. Not a scholarship, a teaching assistantship. In French and not in Spanish.
I don't know if this ever crossed your mind, but the 1960s were a time, and into the 70s, when opportunities were very substantial for young Congolese coming out with professional qualifications, university degrees. By the end of the 1970s, that ceased to be the case in the same way. Mm-hmm. And there were perhaps greater incentives for people to consider whether there might be other options through emigration. Did it cross your mind that this was a moment of unusual opportunity in the Congo itself?
No, actually it didn't, because in part I didn't have the connections that it took. I was from far away in eastern Congo, and Kinshasa I knew was a complicated city. But I did go back after my master's, and in fact, I said, okay, this is it. I'm going home. I will not come back. In 1969, after I received my master's in French now at Iowa, and I can tell you later about how then I decided to choose and not do romance philology. And I went all the way to Kinshasa. I had a friend who had been studying at a small college in Iowa, who made it possible for me to spend a month with his family in Kinshasa while I looked for employment. And indeed, at the time, I was promised two jobs. Either at an administration school, don't remember its name now.
Yes.
École Nationale d'Administration. Yeah. I was promised a job there, and I was promised a job at Kisangani. So I was at the University of Kisangani, Université Libre, at the time. So I was very happy, and I said, look, I haven't seen my family now in 6 years. Allow me to go there. This was September, and then let me know which one I should report to. So I went back to Uvira, and while I was there, I think it was 2 weeks later, I get a letter from Kinshasa saying that the person who was a sub-minister of education, the person who promised me those jobs did not have the authority to do so. So there I was. What to do now? People are looking at me. You've just come back from America. You must have pocketfuls of money. I had exactly $765, which I'd saved, I don't know from what. And So what to do? I was really at a crossroads. And that led me eventually to Tanzania. Yeah, that led me to Tanzania because I had made acquaintances here who had said that they were going to create a school in Dar es Salaam. Sorry, not in Dar es Salaam, but in Bukoba, Tanzania. And that they were looking for people. They were still here, but they were going to go to Tanzania that summer, that fall. And so I got in touch with them, and they said, oh, yes, go on to Dar es Salaam. We'll meet you there, and we'll bring you up to Bukoba. At the same time, though, I had applied to the University of East Africa, whose headquarters were at Makerere. To teach at the university. And in those days, it was still possible to teach with a master's degree. Mm-hmm. And so there I was in Dar es Salaam. My friends were not coming very fast. And before I knew it, Nyerere had nationalized all the schools. He said, no more private schools. All schools will be nationalized. I went to the university and I said, look, I applied to the University of East Africa. And I said, oh, well, that University of East Africa doesn't exist anymore. The three universities are now separate, Nairobi, Makerere, and the University of Dar es Salaam. So you have to start over here. And those were not days of computers and internet where you could, recover things which you've sent. I had sent my only copies of those documents. So what to do? Fortunately, again, I had a friend who was a writer who was in Iowa City, and he sent a message to his friend who was the director of training at the Ministry of Agriculture, who gave me a temporary job as an assistant editor to a Swahili newspaper for agriculture called Ukulima wa Kisasa. So he was a British man, and we became fast friends. But that was not to be either. Very soon, as precisely at the time when I was supposed to get my first salary, a letter comes from the Ministry of Immigration. And it says essentially that I'm a security risk for Tanzania. And I had gone to immigration to apply for a work permit, or the ministry had applied for me for a work permit. And so immigration are saying, no, this man is a security risk. He came here from the U.S. through Congo, and at the time, as you know, Congo and the U.S. were, you know, like were friends, but Tanzania and the U.S. were not. And so there I was stuck there for nearly 6 months working for a laborer's wage and living on the equivalent of $1 a day, 7 shillings at the time. And the ministry then, somebody took pity on me and found me lodging with young British volunteers. And there were many things happening at that time between the US, China, Congo, and Tanzania. A dissertator from Britain, a Nigerian, had come to study, to do research on the relations between China and Tanzania, and he was quickly thrown in jail and quickly released also, and he talked to the newspapers, and I saw one morning newspapers talking about him, and that he found in the jails lots of Congolese and Malawians who had been thrown in there without charge, under suspicion of being spies. So that was something to think about.
I should say.
Yeah, so so again, some stroke of luck, I meet an American who works at the U.S. Embassy, and who says, well, look, if you're having trouble and you want to be a university professor, eventually you're going to need a PhD. So I advise you to leave and go back to Iowa to do a PhD, and I will help you get a visa. And so I wrote back to the University of Iowa with a little difficulty. They said, okay, we'll give you another teaching assistantship. So I came back and did my PhD then.
Were there any mentors or faculty at Iowa that you worked with that were particularly influential to you?
Yeah, I think the most influential professor was Alexandre Aspel. He was a man. I didn't know him that well, but his lectures were just mesmerizing. He taught particularly 19th and 20th century French literature. He had been a refugee from Estonia during the war, and in fact had worked in the French Secret Service. And I just admired him. I just admired the way he presented things and the way he taught. He was not a great scholar, but he was very influential to many, many people. Now, to go back to the reason why I did French in graduate school. I applied to the University of Iowa to the Department of Romance Languages in order to do this Romance philology. But the spring before I was to go, maybe it was even the summer, I get this letter that says the Department of Romance Romance studies or Romance languages has been split into two. Mm-hmm. Department of French and Italian on one side, Department of Spanish and Portuguese on the other. And you have to choose. You can't do both. So there went my dream of Romance philology. And so I decided, well, I don't know where Spanish is going to lead me. But French is going to lead me back to Africa. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I decided. I continued to take Spanish classes in graduate school, but they were, you know, for my interest, for all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But I decided pretty much there and then that I was going to study African literature in French. Well, this had not been done before at the University of Iowa or in very few places in this country. So I couldn't really do it. So I had to follow the normal path, which we still do. You know, you follow, you learn all of French literature, and then you add that what's today called Francophone literature. And so I started reading on my own many African writers, and in fact I decided that for my dissertation I was going to do a dissertation on Sembène Ousmane, just as he was becoming a filmmaker, but I'd read some of his writings. And I was quickly discouraged because I was told, well, look, nobody here can read your dissertation if you write on an African writer. And in fact, nobody was teaching any African literature. So that's how I went to Césaire, because he was a French writer, mm-hmm. surrealist. And there was a man who became the second influential man in my career, and his name is Robert Greene, who decided to take me on, and to take me on to study Césaire as a French surrealist. But I decided that I was going to study Césaire, yes, as a surrealist, but somebody who was attached to Africa. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's how I did that.
That's the connection.
Yeah, that was a connection. Uh-huh. Yeah, that was a connection. And my dissertation was about French surrealism and African surreality in his poetry.
Well, you then had a quite good job to begin with at a major campus of the University of California system at Irvine. How did that opening?
That's yeah. Again, it's my good luck. Pure good luck. That year, 1972, I believe, I was, you know, beginning to write my dissertation. I just had just taken my exams in December of 71, I believe. And I saw how people who were already writing their dissertations were struggling getting jobs. I had, for instance, a colleague who was doing 16th century, and he had written 150 applications the first year. The second year, he had written 200 applications, and he still didn't have a job. So I said, all right, I am going to put myself on the market. It's early, but I'll get the practice. So I wrote 5 letters, University of Vermont, University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh, a university in Puerto Rico. Anyway, California was not part of it. That summer came to Madison a political scientist Barkin, Joel Barkin and his wife. And his wife, Sandy, was, you know, had studied French and so on. They came from Irvine to Iowa City on their way to Kenya for some reason. And they were looking for somebody who could teach them Swahili. So I taught them Swahili. And as they still had contacts at Irvine, one of their friends told them that they had a job. They had just had a conference on Aimé Césaire. And the department has decided to hire somebody who would work in, you know, what's now called Francophone, but who would do Césaire anyway. So, but he said, we already have our candidate. But if this guy wants to come, sure, we'll bring him over and we'll see. But before that, yeah, the other place I had applied was at California State University in Sacramento. And they responded positively, and in fact had brought me to campus, and I was going to teach Swahili, French, in a department that was called the Department of French, Italian, and African Languages. So I went there, and all that was positive. It took a long time for them to come back to me. And then when they heard I had gone to Irvine, they quickly sent me a telegram. Telegrams still existed in those days, saying, okay, we have a job for you, but you have to respond within 48 hours. And at Irvine, I told them that I had been at Sacramento. And there they said, look, if anybody should give you an offer, tell us first. So something miraculous happened, because when I called them up, I had an offer within 24 hours. And that's how that job went. I mean, I went there totally relaxed, not expecting anything, in part because I didn't have a single chapter written on my dissertation yet. I had a good proposal on which I based my job talk. And evidently they liked it. And the job turned out to be very good, although they did not expect me to be teaching African literature and Caribbean literature. They wanted me to teach Césaire and Surrealism. Uh-huh. So that created a little bit of a friction. But I had more students in my classes than the other aspects of French literature had. Uh-huh. Yeah. So that turned out to be really a good job.
So you that soon became a tenure track job, and you wound up staying in Irvine until 1991.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, along with your research and teaching, you developed an administrative capacity.
Bent or something. Yeah, that's... That was a result of my involvement in service, in, you know, the kind of service that faculty do. The Senate had appointed me to a variety of things. I mean, not all at the same time, but one after the other. And I believe it was 1989, we had a new provost. It was called an executive vice chancellor, who was Chinese-American, but he was Chinese. And he wanted to do something about diversity at that campus. And he had come from Berkeley, where he had been a vice chancellor for research. And so he was looking to make a difference in how administration works, that not only administrative types would be in central administration, but bring in faculty members who would have different perspectives on different things. So he sent out feelers. I mean, he called me very late. He sent out feelers to me about that, and resisted for weeks. So finally, he called me up himself, and I just got married to Emily in 1988. I said, "Look, I'm a newlywed. I'm going on a trip." And well, I said, "Well, when you come back, call me up." So he was very persuasive, and that's how I became a special assistant. It's called faculty assistant to the executive vice chancellor. In fact, it was a position that was equivalent to a vice provost. For diversity now, but it was affirmative action then, and my role at, I think I began at 30% or something like that in administration. My role was to find ways of bringing in more minority faculty, and in fact we were able to double at least the African American faculty within mm-hmm. 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. Because of different strategies that we devised. And it was during this time that Madison came calling.
And you evidently had administrative talents that perhaps you hadn't realized, as suggested by your career since that time. Regular reconscriptions for administrative roles.
Yeah. You know, when I came here, well, when I left, actually, when I left Irvine, When Irvine made a counteroffer, one of my conditions was, I don't want to do administration. Yes, yeah. I was in administration, but I said, look, the counteroffer you're going to make, don't include any administration in it, because I want to go back. Because it was impossible to work at 30%. Eventually, I asked them to do 50-50. At least I was going to get a decent salary while spending so much time really inventing something that was not existent mm-hmm. at the time. So when I came here, for the first 10 years, I did not put in my CV that I had been that I had been in administration. And so the first thing that happened here, I believe that was in 2001 when I became Director of African Studies. And it was, I believe, Jim and Tom, at a time when really not too many people wanted to do it, mm-hmm. who persuaded me to do the directorship of African Studies. Mm-hmm. And they convinced me that it wasn't going to be much work. Most of the work was going to be done by the associate director and so on. So that's what happened at the time, and I spent 3 years doing that. Strangely enough, these administrative stints, except at Irvine, come either just before or just after I've had some time off to do my research. And even what I have now, I had a year at the Institute for Research in the Humanities before Southall twisted my arm into doing this. Administrative talents, I don't know. I just do what I can for French and Italian. It was something of a dare. I accepted to do it. I was asked by three colleagues to do it, and ultimately it was okay. It was okay. This is much more difficult. Mm-hmm. It's smaller, but it's much, much more difficult because we're a small department, and in a small department you don't find enough people to do a variety of things. And what I learned in administration way back from Irvine is that departments have cultures. And those cultures are extremely difficult to change. Yeah. Yeah. And so the culture of the French department is one that, everybody pulls his weight and you can assign things and things will get done. The culture of this department has been different.
Yes, it does have a very interesting set of quite distinctive personalities in it, and
yes, and challenges, and different relationships, and when I came in here, all of a sudden I found myself after I'd accepted losing three or even four colleagues from active duty, if you will, so I had to take more on than I thought I was going to. There's always that. You were a dean many times, so
what happens, indeed.
Yeah.
So let's turn back to your research. You've mentioned your connection with M.A. Césaire, and a good bit of your major work has revolved around M.A. Césaire. He's been a lifelong fascination for you. How do you explain that?
Much to my surprise, because I thought, okay, I've done the book on M.A. Césaire, now let me do something else. What I wanted to do, two projects that I had been working on were, the period following Negritude, that's one, and the second, more recently, has been on film. But strangely enough, I kept being pulled back to M.A. Césaire because of his weight, not only in Francophone literature in general, but his influence on even African perceptions of political perceptions, but also literary perceptions. And, you know, he died recently. This is the year of his 100th birthday.
Oh, yes.
And there are celebrations all over, more in Africa than in the Caribbean. In Dakar, they had a lot of things going. Recently, in Fort-de-France, in Martinique, they had a big conference. And here in September, I'm going to Paris, actually to a place called Cerisy, where they've had a tradition of holding week-long conferences on a given author or a given question, philosophical, literary, or whatever. And so once more, I am going there. And I was there in 2008, there was something on him. I went to Libreville in 2011. And interestingly enough, I'm now merging Césaire with cinema. And the paper I'm going to be giving there is called Césaire au cinéma. Because, and I said that he has a great deal of influence in Africa, there is a filmmaker from Mali and Mauritania by the name of Abderrahmane Sissako, who did this one film called Life on Earth. And the objective of the film, it's a part documentary, but it's not really a documentary, was to reflect on the beginning of the new century. There's this filmmaking outfit called Arte that invited a dozen filmmakers around the world to reflect on what the beginning of the new century would be. Sissako decided that he was the only African picked, that he was going to go back to his father's village in Mali. But this reflects on the major work by Césaire, the first major work by Césaire called Return to My Native Land. So in the whole film is infused with quotations of Césaire, of that work, Return to My Native Land, as well as of discourse on colonialism. So that's that's something. I don't know what will come of that, and I keep saying, well, no, now I'm going to, you know, do something else. I keep coming back to Césaire.
So I will remember when I was a student at Sciences Po in 56, 57, spending a lot of time with the African students, especially their very leftist organization, FEOF, that the tremendous impact that his 1956, I believe it was, Letter of Maurice Torres, where he takes the French Communist Party to task for its ambivalent stand on colonialism.
And supporting the Hungarian invasion by the Soviet Union,
So let's say a few words about your teaching, the teaching part of your career. What have been some of its highlights and satisfactions?
Yeah, you know, when I came here, well, first of all, to go back to the hiring process, I was surprised by the phone call. It came from a colleague by the name of Judy Miller, saying we have a position here in the French department. And at the time, there were very, very few places, if any, that were hiring more than one person to do Francophone literature. And I had always thought of Idriss as being in the French department. And I said to Judy, look, you already have somebody. Why do you want me? And she said, at the time, she said, no, Idriss is in African Languages and Literature. We want someone in this department to create a program of Francophone studies. And so I began to look at this seriously, and I knew, or I discovered, the extent to which Wisconsin is a power in African studies.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I regretted about being at the University of California, Irvine, is that my Africanist side was being neglected in that I did not have a group of people that I could talk to about African anything. So at the time I didn't even know that there was a department and a program. So I began to look at it seriously. And it took a while. It took really a year of back and forth until I came to the interview. And they had only picked two people. The other one is Central African Republic man, Jonathan Gatte, and we didn't come together, of course, but we were the only two interviewed for the position. And then I began to discover that the French department here, French and Italian department, was the biggest such department in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. And that it had a lot. I mean, I'd seen many names that I did not recognize at the time as being from here. It has been and it remains one of the major departments of French and Italian, because if the Italian section itself were a department, it would be as large as African Langues et Lettres, actually.
Oh, really?
Larger. And it's the largest in the U.S. for sure, but the second largest in North America. Toronto is bigger. So then, you know, I began to warm up to the idea, because when I left Iowa to go to California, I swore never again to live in the Midwest. I hate winters. here I was, and I'm glad I made the move. And more recently, I learned that my old department doesn't exist anymore.
Okay.
In California. Yeah, great attrition. They didn't renew people who left, and so the last two that I saw were sent into different departments. Yeah.
Hmm. So it certainly worked to your advantage in every respect. In your career here, partly because you acquired a reputation, I believe, as somebody who had a range of knowledge extending beyond your own immediate specialization, and set a kind of trans-campus network. You've been on a couple of major search committees. The one that came up with the name of Gary Sandifer, among others, in that would have been 10 years ago.
Something like that, yes.
Since he's just completed 2 5-year terms. And then our late and alas controversial chancellor,
mm-hmm.
Biddy Martin. Could you say a few words about those search committee experiences?
Mm. Yeah, they were always eye-openers, because you got to learn how the university works, how the college works, what's important to people. And I think, for instance, Gary Sandifer impressed us by his quiet demeanor and way of doing things that were, you know, very much the kind of thing that Wisconsin wants. you got to learn the interests of many aspects of the university. That, you know, you go in there thinking faculty interests are paramount, but you learn that other interests are also important, and that in the end, whoever makes the final choice will have the difficult task of bringing all these interests together and selecting the kind of person that they think will be, you know, best for the campus in general. And that goes for the chancellor's search committee as well. And but as you know, ultimately it's the regents who make the final decision. But that was a very big committee. I think we were 17 or something like that, and with a very different viewpoints, including the community, donors, and so forth. And you had to take all those things into consideration. They were important experiences for me, and sometimes I think about African universities and how they are run. It's not at all anything like this, because there it's simply top down, whereas here you have to discuss those things democratically and go on. It's I was just the other day, I think, discussing with Emily how in the committee for the chancellor, you know, when the regents came in, because the regents appoint a subcommittee to deal with the search committee, even though they had asked us to give them four names, I think, unranked, when they came, they actually went person by person to ask us our ranking and our opinion each candidate. Yes, and so, and then they went and made the final decision. Yeah.
As I recollect, one of the four people withdrew before there was a final decision.
Yes, somebody who had been here before. And
yeah, and then, if my memory is correct, a second person attracted some degree of controversy in the student press. And I do remember one of the regents telling me after the fact that they really didn't think they had much choice.
Yes.
When they
told us, well, we had a reception somewhere afterwards, and they said that there isn't much choice in terms of experience. Mm-hmm. She had the best experience.
Yeah.
The chancellor who just came in was...
Was she?
Yes, she was.
She was the first.
Yes, I remember her very well. And as a matter of fact, many... committee members
liked her better.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Interesting.
Very.
Yeah. A couple of other important roles that you've played over the years. You've been president of two important associations, professional associations, the African Studies Association and the African Literature Association.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, what do you recollect, what stands out in your memories of those roles?
Well, I came into the presidency of the African Studies Association at a very difficult time. And so there's some things that did not work out well. First of all, when I was vice president, as we were coming to the 50th anniversary conference, I was also chair of the Department of French and Italian. I had been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and subsequently went into an operation. Emily had just left to go to Berkeley, and I must say the secretariat wanted to have its way in, and also the program chair had not been someone who knew the African Studies Association that well, and came in with a theme that was supposed to be watertight. Either your paper was on the theme or it wasn't. And by the way, also that summer I was teaching in Paris, and by the time I came back, there was a big brouhaha about the, you know, people who had, important people who had been, and important papers that had been not selected. And so I called the secretariat and said, give me a couple of weeks to resolve this. And they said, no, it's too late. We have to go to press and so on and so forth. But I, something I learned that's very good about ASA, you know, leadership is that the board can be important. And I had not served on the board. And I think by the time I left, I had impressed upon the board never to nominate someone who had not served on the board first as vice president. Because that experience is very good. You get to know the organization much better. During my year of the presidency, it was much better. But we had a financial crisis. That's when we started to cut out the AV and so forth, and people are not happy. They have found a way to do it better now, and it's not as expensive as it was supposed to be. I mean, that was costing us $150,000each time. So those were my crises at ASA. ALA was something different. At ASA, I was drafted. ALA was a much younger organization. I think you were president of ASA when I was president of ALA at one point. Mm-hmm. And it was a much smaller organization. Again, it sort of came more or less naturally that I should become vice president first and then president, because in part because I was active, I was presenting good papers. I was even the ALA logo is one that I devised back then. I was president twice, 10 years apart, mm-hmm. and then organized the big conference, 30th mm-hmm. anniversary conference here. It has grown and has its own difficulties, but it's a very important association. Mm-hmm. as well. And by the way, the ALA was created in part because literary scholars felt that the ASA was not serving its interests mm-hmm. or their interests. And so, but now those interests are listened to and the ALA is an associate member of the ASA. So, mm-hmm. so there's a much healthier relationship between the two Africanist associations now.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, let's turn to your family. Your wife, whom you mentioned, you married, I think, in
1978?
88. Emily. And she was from also African, but from a different country. Mm-hmm. And your dream of being a doctor was finally realized through one of your daughters, I believe.
Well, I hope so. She's just beginning now, medical school, not because I put any pressure on her. Meeting Emily was a very important occasion for me. We met in her country, in Cameroon. I had gone there in 1983 as a Fulbright scholar. Mm-hmm. And so one day we just met, and it took a while from 1983 when we met until 1988. It took 5 years before we could get together because of different issues. When I was finished with my Fulbright stint, I came back to Irvine, and she went to Great Britain for 6 months. Then eventually she came to Mount Holyoke in Massachusetts. And so during that whole time, we were dealing, and there was also, you know, the idea was not very well accepted right away by by a family, so we had to negotiate. We had to negotiate things with the family for a variety of reasons, not only age difference, but cultural differences, where we lived and grew up, and so on. But of course, it's been a great thing in my life. We have three beautiful children. And
it's the oldest who is in medical school, just beginning medical school.
Yes, the oldest. Tosha is, and our children are named after family members. Tosha was my mother's name. So she's just beginning this fall. And then we have two who are hell-bent to play basketball.
I remember your older son was a star player for Madison Memorial.
Yes, and he actually spent a year playing at the University of Illinois Chicago, which is where his sister is going now. Mm-hmm. But he has decided now to transfer to a smaller college in western Minnesota, Moorhead State University. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. But Emily went into librarianship and has done exceedingly well with her career. So we have had many great experiences together, professionally, as well as in the family here and our families back in Cameroon and Congo.
Is there anything we've left out?
I don't think so. You know, I've sort of rambled. I don't think so. You know, I'm looking forward to a retirement soon.
Birth year was further back than I realized. So you're certainly old enough to retire when you wish to.
Yes, and
but you're fully active and.
Yeah, I'll continue to be active, and maybe that's something I should talk about, because it's big, something that's becoming more important in the activities that I do that are not necessarily scholarly for me. But several years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I began to become interested in parks, people, conservation, and especially conservation of the Congo Basin forests. Mm-hmm. And as you know, 60% of Congo Basin forests are in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where I'm from. We, with a colleague and with the International Studies Division, we have managed to link the university to the partnership for Congo Basin Forests, which brings together 10 African countries of Central Africa with nearly a dozen countries of the North who are interested in these issues. And we have signed agreements with the University of Chang in Cameroon, because it's very important in these areas. In fact, right now we're hoping that they will get an $8 million grant to develop a program in the green economy at the University of Chang. But we also, through the African Development Bank, interested in capacity building at École de Faune de Garoua, so it's a wildlife college, and to try to train their staff there, perhaps hopefully by next summer, bring some of them here for a short period of time, and sending people in those areas, conservation environment, there to train them. So this is something I'm doing, and it's probably going to extend beyond retirement. Yeah.
Very good. Well, then, this concludes the oral history interview with Aliko Sangolo. Thank you very much, Aliko.
Thank you.